This is day two of the 1989 Idyllwild Bible School. Our second period teacher is Brother Frank Abel, and his general subject is Haggai. His subtopic for today's class is Consider Thy Ways.
Well, good morning, everyone. I always like Tuesdays at Bible school because we've had enough time to get settled in. Everyone probably has recovered from the journey. We have put another day between us and the activities of the world, and probably are more energetic now towards trying to learn something and benefit from the school than any other time in the week. So it's got to be a pretty productive morning. And this theme that we're going to discuss this morning somewhat is obviously can't be contained in any one day in this subject, but consider your ways really requires every one of us to do some thinking. As we illustrated yesterday, the intention of taking a class like this and looking at Haggai is not so much to know what happened then, but to run it parallel in our own life and to look at the highlights of the study, to gain the basic understanding of the subject, and then to say, well, how does it apply to us? And to realize, as I'm sure we do, that as we open the Bible and we see people of other ages encountering the difficulties they had, it's just typical human behavior. So we can't write them off as a very wicked generation or an unfaithful generation. We just have to accept that's what we would probably be doing ourselves had we lived in that time. Well, what I'd like to do this morning is just read Haggai 1 to start with, and then we'll do a little review and get into this theme. So reading from the prophecy of Haggai, chapter 1. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jozadak the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh Yahweh of hosts, saying, This people say the time is not come, the time that Yahweh's house should be built. Then came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Consider your ways. You have sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Consider your ways. Go up to the mountain, and bring wood, and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith Yahweh. Ye looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith Yahweh of hosts? Because of mine house that is waste. And ye run every man unto his own house. Therefore the heaven over you has stayed from dew, and the earth has stayed from her fruit. And I called for a drought upon the land, and upon the mountains, and upon the corn, and upon the new wine, and upon the oil, and upon that which the ground bringeth forth, and upon men, and upon cattle, and upon all the labor of the hands. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of Yahweh their God, and the words of Haggai the prophet, as Yahweh their God had sent him, and the people did fear before Yahweh. Then spake Haggai, Yahweh's messenger, in Yahweh's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith Yahweh. And Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and did work in the house of Yahweh of hosts, their God, in the 24th day of the 6th month, in the 2nd year of Darius the king. And of course, for much of the Bible, you really don't need to do much more than just read it and reread it. And the exhortations meet us each time we encounter them. And that will be one of the objects of each of our classes, is to read and familiarize ourselves again and again with the key phrases of this prophecy. The people had said, the time hasn't come. Why did they say that? Because they must have known a little bit about the dates in which the captivity took place, and were able to reason, rationalize, if you like. They were able to procrastinate such that the work stopped and did not continue. Because as you notice, from the year 606 to the year 536, and from the year 586 to the year 516, or 270-year periods. And the people wouldn't have known exactly what the starting date was. That's a lot of the problems for us today, is we don't know the starting date exactly of a time period. So this 586 was not the only time that Nebuchadnezzar took away captives. Neither did the people know just what the terminal date would be, whether it would be the return from captivity, 536, or whether it would be indeed 516, the time that the temple would be completed. So it's important to understand those dates and to see how there was a base for people to reason the time has not yet come. But God never intended that the work should have stopped. Even though persecution had grown to the place, or to the point where the people that were opposing them with force and power stopped them from building, God never intended that they should stop. And so for those 15 years, God was working through the way he works, through the chastening hand. And they went out in the fields and they labored, and the fields didn't produce. And they tended their flocks and their flocks didn't produce. And I suppose that even as he says his curse was upon the people, that even they didn't produce. And God intended it. They should have seen in that his hand upon them, that they might get back to the work. However, God's mercy was there in the prophet Haggai and Zechariah, who, not because it was their determination to stand up and to speak, but God moved them at the right time to stand up to these people and to speak these words. And they considered their ways. And they were told what to consider: the chastening hand of God. And all of the people responded in verse 12. It says, they obeyed the voice of Yahweh their God through the words of Haggai the prophet and commenced to build. And God didn't ask them to do great things initially. He just said, look, go up to the mountain and bring wood. Little things, anything, but get back to working. And I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified. Now, brothers and sisters, the exhortation in that is just load it. But it needs to be, as we mentioned earlier, chewed finer. We need to think at a lower level in our lives in order to try to bring this to have the greatest benefit for us all. Now, we must see in ourselves, in our personal lives, the parallel. We are not building a literal temple. If we were, then of course the exhortation would be that much stronger. But we are all building. And we are first of all building character. And the chastening hand of God is working with us just as much today as it ever was. We should be able to see the hand of God in our lives. But it's not just personal. We are building families. We are building children. We are doing things that are going to result one way or another in what other people do. We're trying to build in the ecclesia. We're building together. Very often, we're building right next to someone. And our lives and their lives are next to each other. And sometimes that's the most difficult aspect of building. But have we said in our heart, the time has not come? Brothers and sisters, I can tell by the number of older brothers and sisters here that you have been listening to the coming of the Lord for many years. And having read the books and the beliefs of John Thomas and Dr. Roberts, or sorry, Dr. Thomas and John Roberts, John Thomas and Robert Roberts, and our pioneers on this subject, we know that they expected that the Lord's coming would be imminent. And yet things do go on, and things seem to be like the days of Zephaniah, when the people said, well, God won't do good, then he won't do ill. God just doesn't seem to be interested. But I'm sure that those, I hope all of us who are watching, know that even though we saw 1947 and 1948, two of the probably key years in Bible prophecy that were ever seen in the last millennium, when the United Nations and the nations of the world for a moment of time favored Zion. After all the years that where the people have been banished and persecuted and the atrocities that have been committed against these people for a little time, they favored the partitioning of Palestine. And then the formation of the Israeli state, and people who had read the work of John Thomas and knew that it wasn't because it was likely in his days that he wrote those things, but because he was able to see that's what the scriptures required. We're then seeing a vindication of God's name with all the skeptics and the scoffers that live out there who constantly say that the Bible is just the work of a few men who tried to put things together. Here was the vindication of God's name, and certainly a great assistance to those who looked for these things. But a lot of those people that saw those things are no longer with us. And others who never saw 1948 saw 1967. And they saw that the words of the Lord Jesus Christ, that that city would be trodden down until the times of the Gentiles would be fulfilled, saw a little indication that the Gentiles haven't been thrown totally out of that city, and we know that the city must fall again. But they saw something that had never been seen since those words of Jesus, that now the Jews had control of that old city. And again, for people who were looking at the Bible and expecting these things, that was good news, a vindication of people who put their trust in God and indeed God's word. And then in 1973, we saw the events in this part of the world of what events in that part of the world can do. And I think it was really an indication to all of us that as we have seen things go a little differently than we may have imagined, especially with this man Gorbachev that's come to the scene, so economic factors became a major concern. Whereas in the early 60s, people were concerned about nuclear war and the idea of building bomb shelters and whether or not there would be that intercontinental ballistic war that people thought when Khrushchev sent his missiles to Cuba. But now, when they turned off the oil, and people were acting like animals when it came to lining up at the gas pumps and not being able to follow their normal way of life, we began to see, I believe, and were warned, that this world is extremely vulnerable to economic you might say disasters, you might just say peaks and valleys in the stock market. And we were shown, I believe, that we've got to be on guard. Then in 1978 and moving into the 80s, we've seen other things. We saw the war where Israel fought against in Lebanon, and moved up into Lebanon in what was called the high-tech war. We're sending up planes that could monitor the Syrians. They were able to shoot down something like 80 aircraft without losing one. Illustrating that war is so different today. And that we have to consider, I believe, all of God's word in order to, I think, to meet the challenge of the day and to be ready and to watch, as he said. So people who may have lost heart that 1988 came and went, and they thought, well, there's the 40-year period. Surely the Lord would come in that 40-year period, and it didn't happen. They have no reason to ever lose faith. And what we're seeing happen in Israel, what we're seeing happening in Russia, are momentous things today. We're seeing Israel still isolate itself from the world. And we're seeing it to be one of the few remaining areas of the world that the world cannot solve. The problems there seem to be unsolvable. And certainly it's this controversy of Zion trying to put peace there, which is going to bring the nations down for that great battle near the city of Jerusalem. Look at what's happening in Moscow. I mean, unbelievable. We wouldn't have thought of this 15 years ago. Having gone through Stalin and Khrushchev and Brezhnev and all those old men of the old flag, and now seeing this man come on the scene, and yet for people who are watching, this is exactly what we've been waiting for. Well, we've seen those things in Moscow, when we've been watching in Jerusalem, there's another man been going around the world, bringing all the world to this idea of peace, peace, wearing his white robes and drawing them in by the hundreds of thousands. And you don't think it's strong today? It's strong back home. You know, the Catholic presence may not be strong in certain ways, but the government of Ontario just moved the law to give full funding of the public purse to the Catholic school system. Now that shows you the root strength of the system. It's there, it's potentially there everywhere in great strength. But the idea of today is peace, peace. What did he tell us, brothers and sisters? Just look at this again for a moment. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, chapter 5 rather. He says, but of the times and of the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you. For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction shall come upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. But ye, brethren, are not in darkness that that day should overtake you as a thief. And we got a building to do, and the building is to build in our lives, in our families, in our ecclesias, and to pass off what's going on in the world scene as, well, the time hasn't come. You know, things are pretty peaceful here. We don't need to worry. Is to ignore all the signs that our Lord has given us, graciously given us, that we are living right on the brink. Peace and safety, then sudden destruction. Well, you know, that's exactly the communist doctrine that was preached long before Gorbachev or Brezhnev or any of those leaders came on the scene, by those Lenin and Marx who started this whole system off. They preached a doctrine that they would, by great overtures and peace agreements, they would lull the West into thinking that they had finally accomplished peace. And then he said, when their guard is down, we'll smash them with our clenched fist. That's communist policy. And yet you see what's happening in Europe. What's happening to some extent here in America and around the world is the guard is dropping. But for brothers and sisters, this is exactly what we expected through this time of peace and safety. And the writer goes on to say that it will be like travail upon a woman with child, speaking of the crippling, the paralyzing birth pangs that finally bring forth birth. So we're not questioning whether there will be a birth. There's no reason that anyone should ever think because 1988 came in the 40-year period we thought would bring our Lord means that there's no longer going to be birth. Pregnancy is obvious. It's just when will the birth take place? And many of us have known the amount of false labor that sometimes comes before the true thing. All of it has its purpose to make birth possible. Brethren and sisters, it's a great time to really consider our ways with respect to the temple that we're building. How far have we got along? You have a look at Matthew 24. The Lord seems to put an option before us. In this parable that he speaks in verse 42, "Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in which watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man cometh. Who then is that faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing." Now there is the call, brothers and sisters, today. God has given us this charge in the ecclesial temple that we're building and trying to assist others to build in a way that meshes with other brothers and sisters. That's not at odds with them. That's not that can't mesh with them to build a strong temple, but something that considers one another. And this seems to be one of the hardest lessons to learn in building, is to learn to build together. Again, that independent spirit, I'll build my life and there it is. But God's calling is to build it together. So that the disciples who were even with the Lord for 3 years, walking with him, did not understand the building together. And they were wondering who would be the greatest, even at the Lord's Supper, that he so desired to have with them. There was a debate amongst them, a dispute, an argument, who would be the greatest. And our Lord illustrated how patient he was, how patient we must be with our brothers and sisters, who may display those same kinds of tactics even in the memorial meeting. And then he showed himself to be a servant. He didn't verbally cut them down. He showed what service was and left that as the main motivating fact. But when Peter, the impetuous one, kept on saying he wouldn't deny his Lord, maintained a stand the Lord knew wasn't right, he said to him, Peter, when you're converted, strengthen your brethren. I have found that a very, very moving statement. That you could walk with the Lord for 3 years and you could see his miracles, you could hear his parables, you could ask for a special understanding in those parables, you could participate in the miracles as he did. He had the Spirit, he went out, he did them himself. Still not be converted. When we're baptized, brothers and sisters, we are not necessarily converted in that area. When thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. That's where it's so difficult to be converted and to understand what God requires of us. But I believe there's something more fundamental than this building in the ecclesial temple and even the family temple. And brothers and sisters, it doesn't seem to be there in great amounts or great quantity amongst us. This society we live in is robbing us of our personal integrity. Society is catering to people who are dishonest. And some businesses, you will know that it's almost necessary to be dishonest to be in the business. We must never lose personal integrity. There's no way we can build in the ecclesia. There's no way we can raise children. In fact, I don't even know there's any way we can keep a marriage together if we don't have personal integrity. And the Bible tells us so much about this. Just have a look at a couple of passages. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Now, one of the requirements, brothers and sisters, for a dedicated worker in the temple who is going to be active in providing food for what others need and not losing heart and going out to beat and to flog his fellow servants is separation. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. "Be you not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion hath light with darkness? What concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? What agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be you separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. And then verse 1 of chapter 7. Having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Now, that's a very high and lofty calling. There's probably none of us that are separate like this. But that's the call. And we live in an age where it is very, very difficult to be that separate. I mean, everything that the media throws at us is to be involved, is to entice us, is to desire our participation. In business, seeing a Christadelphian astute about things, a person who is conscientious about work, a person who is prepared to be there on time and work a full day, there's all kinds of extra temptations where people will offer special things to you that you can advance up the ladder. It's a very subtle age, brothers and sisters, that we're in, and we have to look carefully. It's made me personally look and examine everything about this society and try to determine what should be accepted and kept and what should be discarded, so that we come out from among them and be separate, so that we might, in that separateness, have time, have energy, and have resources to dedicate to the building of the temple. Facts are, we're being choked. And I know this, brothers and sisters, because I'm saying it myself. I know what it's like to live out there. You know what it's like to live out there. I'm sure we would agree that one of the reasons why we are not stronger in our community is because many of these things are choking the growth. If you worked in a garden a little, where there's a little more water than maybe here, you would notice that weeds grow so much faster than the plants you really want to see grow. And how you have to be diligent about your life, or else you find yourselves being caught up in these ways. You know, how much time do we spend on the Rams? You know, or on the Lakers? Or on the Kings? Or on the Blue Jays, or the Maple Leafs, or you've probably never heard of the Argonauts. You know, those are really time consumers. And for people who have grown up with it, it's very, very difficult. The temptation is so real. Well, you know, that's when we got to put some of these survival tactics into place. And the Lord said, if you want to be in the kingdom and your hand offends you, cut it off. And if that's a problem for us, then that's how basic we have to think. That if something is taking our time or our energy or our resources such that it's hindering our building, far better we cut it off. Being human nature, that's probably the only way we can handle it. Now, I want you to think a little bit, because as I mentioned earlier, it's a thinking session today. I put these things together. They're not intended to be exhaustive. There may even be some discussion as to whether they should be there. But what I've tried to do was just look at life and say, how much of this is there because man is there without God? It's sort of like looking around society and saying, well, here's a number of things that society offers us. You must get it all the time. We get it up in Canada. Junk mail comes through there. You got your name printed on it. You have won $1 million. When you open it up, you haven't won $1 million at all. But that's the enticement to get in that envelope. And this is typical of the world today. Well, how much of this is just purely put there for the man of the world so that we know clearly what to distinguish as good and evil? I don't know if you can see that, but I'll read it for the sake of the tapes anyway. And that is that when you look at security, what is it that people desire in the world today to feel secure? And this is not putting any connotation of bad or good on them. It's just trying to look at all the things that you might think of whereby people feel secure. So if you happen to be a very smart person, and you know that because of your record, then you would feel likely somewhat more secure because of your intelligence, knowing that you can pick up, possibly if something else goes wrong, you can take on some other endeavor. If you happen to have a good career or a career that's moving today where a lot of others are drying up, it's also a sense of security because this is likely to continue on and on. You could always get a job in this area and you tend to feel secure in those in that particular situation. Whenever we have good health, we feel better. I'm sure that you've experienced the same thing. If you feel healthy, you feel that you can accomplish things, you're not afraid of tasks, and it makes you feel confident. Wealth in today's world speaks as loud as it ever did. For people who have wealth, it's very difficult sometimes to see the difference between what God offers us and what wealth can offer us. But piousness is there. We tend to gravitate to the fact that if we're better than someone else, then we're all right in the sight of God. And I'm really missing the sway of many arguments in the scriptures that the whole generation was not acceptable to God. But piousness is a means of security. You know, our lovely homes, that we can get out of the world and all the hustle and bustle of the world, we can go back to our lovely homes and we can feel secure and we can feel comfortable. Routine. Just the fact that we get into a routine. You ever see people that get out of routine and they're absolutely hopeless if they happen to get out of the routine of being able to get up at a certain hour and go to bed at a certain hour. And the routine makes people feel confident, makes them feel secure. Good times. You know, if you know if the economy is booming and you know that business is good, you tend to feel more confident because of that. Intoxicants. Well, when things aren't working too well, intoxicants are often the route. Almost in some cases, invariably the route that people go. And it's not just chemical. When people come home and they bury themselves in the newspaper or in a magazine or in front of the TV, very often the whole reason behind that is just to cover up the day's activities, get it out of their mind. They feel secure and just intoxicating themselves to reality for a time. Privacy. Privacy is a survival skill for people under pressure, just to go away and be alone for 5 minutes. Which, strangely enough, is why the washrooms are occupied so much in certain businesses, that people find the only way they can get away from the telephone and interruptions is just to go and be in the washroom for 5 minutes, and you get that peace of mind. That's the kind of society we live in. Then, of course, pensions. I'm not talking about anything the Bible speaks of here, but I'm thinking about the pensions that this world offers, that you can build it up and build it up and build it up. So this secure feeling that, well, when I retire, I'll be looked after. And then, of course, with medicine, depending on our history, that may or may not be a case. But certainly many people have been able to find that if you ever have anything go wrong with them, you can get a pill, you take the pill, you feel better. If you've never been seriously ill, that can be a sense of security for you. Other people. Well, many people are leaners. You take away the one they're leaning on, they fall over. And security is not really where it ought to be in life. It's in other people. And, of course, we go on in insurance, a very, very big business today where people insure themselves for a great number of things. I'm not too sure there isn't much you can insure yourself for. And then the judicial system. It's really not spelled that way in Canada. But, nevertheless, the judicial system that if things go bad, that really there is enough justice out there that someone's going to stand up for you yet. Now, I don't know whether that's you would necessarily agree with that list or whether that list is exhaustive or whether it should be graded as some are more impressive than others. But when you go and open the Bible and you go down this list, you can see that almost every single one of those has a word of caution associated with it. Now, I don't intend to go all through this. If you're trying to copy this down, let's leave that till after the class, because I don't want to take the time up to go through all of these. But for instance, in just the first few, intelligence. And the Bible clearly tells us that there's not many men who are wise after the flesh that are ever called. Being wise is not an advantage in coming to accept biblical principles. Many men glory in their wisdom, not understanding that we should glory in God's wisdom. Careers are divisive. We always then seem to be caught between a master on one side and a master on the other side. And we have to prioritize our life, not always getting that right. Good health, again, it's not to glory in our might. And if we happen to be of the spirit of wanting to stand up alone, good health quite often doesn't assist us in the things of the truth. And on you go. And we may talk about some of these things a little more later, but I think that's a necessary sort of route in life for all of us to take stock of where we are. When he says to consider your ways, he's saying that in light of the temple we're building. We're trying to build character. We're trying to build families. We're trying to build ecclesias. And these things, which were put there largely for men, which are the idea of men and how you can go through life feeling secure without God. Now, I'm going to try to put this into a class in a little more detail than I have now. But Revelation 16 has an awful lot to say for the days in which we live. Where we were told, if you read Elpa's Israel very clearly, the I believe the right and proper understanding of Revelation 16, when it spoke of three frog-like spirits coming out of the mouth of the false prophet, the mouth of the dragon, and the mouth of the beast. Now, a lot of the interpretation of Revelation is pointing towards the French Revolution. The French Revolution is quite topical this year. 200 years ago is when it occurred, in fact, just a month. The French Revolution, what preceded it, what happened afterward, really does show how this society is governed. And if you look at the prelude to the French Revolution, and you look at the people like Rousseau and Voltaire, philosophers who preceded it and wrote about society without God, and then how people like Lamarck and Buffon and Darwin wrote about a scientific explanation where you didn't need God. That the philosophy and the science coming together now destroyed people's belief in God largely and started the socialism and the humanism which is so strong in our society. So this is not coming from a godly society. It's coming from largely a godless society. But we can't build this temple. We can't build personally. We can't build ecclesially. We can't build strong families if we default to the way of the world. And I think we do that too often. We think that, well, our children are finished secondary school now, so you go to college. Why do you go to college? Where does the Bible say you go to college after secondary school? It's just man's way of life. Everybody else does it. Does that mean we do it? I mean, that's just a typical thing that we should question. We should question everything, brothers and sisters, so that we can remain separate. And in being separate, we will have the time, we will have the energy, we'll have the resources to dedicate to this building we're doing. Let's have a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Sometimes we can lose sight of this. I find it very helpful when a brother who is presiding on a Sunday morning mentions things like this just prior to giving the emblems. Verse 19. What, he says, know you not that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit which is in you, which you have of God, and you are not your own? For you are bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. Now, we have to keep telling ourselves this. We have to repeat this and repeat this. And that's scriptural. Because quite often, especially in Peter, the epistles of Peter and in Jude, he is telling you, you once knew this, but I want you to remember it again. We should do the same thing. We, in being baptized, were purchased. We are no longer our own to go off in the pursuits of our own endeavor. Our way of life must be governed by the fact that we have been purchased. But that's very easy to lose sight of. We still inwardly think we have the freedom to do what we like. And as the writer of Ecclesiastes says, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set to do evil. And God doesn't strike us down. We don't have an immediate thing. I suppose, looking back over 15 years of our life, we should be able to see the chastening of the Lord from time to time. But there's nothing immediate. So that largely a person can waste their time, waste their energy, waste their resources, and nothing happens. And if that becomes a regular pattern of life, we forget all about the fact we've been bought. We're purchased people. We're special. We've got to show forth the praises of our God in our body, in our life, in our families, every way we can. Look at Isaiah chapter 57. Brothers and sisters, I'm sure that these verses are dear to you. They're dear to me. They're not so dear to us initially in life, but as we walk through the various periods of life, through raising children, to have those children marry, through having careers to the point where we're just about ready to retire, or things like that, these verses mean so much more to us. Isaiah 57, and then looking at verse 15. For thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is Holy, I dwell in the high and holy place, with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble, to revive the heart of the contrite ones. Now, I don't believe that in any sense refers to people who turn on contriteness and turn it off. People who can live a life for a short time in the presence of their brothers and sisters, or in a short time in front of their family, and then turn it off. Now, this is consistent contriteness of a humble spirit. Now, that's got substance to it, brothers and sisters. If we don't know what that means, then we really should look into it much further. Because when you behold the skies as you can up here, and you can see the stars, and you think of this high and lofty one that inhabits eternity, whose name is Holy, would even contemplate saying in this book, the Bible, that he would dwell with us, we must never forget that holiness. I believe that is absolutely important to personal integrity. What we've been trying to point out to the young people, and it's certainly not just an exhortation for young people, is that if we believe that angel is with us, brothers and sisters, which we ought to because the scriptures do tell us that, then we better not offend him, because he will depart. That's clearly established in the Old Testament, where the angel was, or they were told about the angel, that if they didn't even maintain sanitary conditions in the camp, the angel would be offended and would depart from them. When we want our angel to be with us, and we contemplate an angel being with us such that in our imagination, the angel's there, can't see him, but he's there, then that controls what music we listen to. We don't want to offend that angel. We need that angel. That controls our minds, what we think of, because the angel knows our minds. That controls our whole behavior. And we can have it both ways, that this works when we need him, but when we don't need him, we can do what we like. We're bought, purchased people who don't have that, or don't have that freedom to go back into the world. We're being called out of it. We must stay out of it. We must be consistent in our life. I was interested to hear our first brother speak about the separation that we need and about idleness. And did you notice in the reading this morning that we read about David, that this was one time David did not go out with Joab to warfare. He stayed at home. And what happened when he stayed at home? All the events of that chapter. Now we've got to be busy. We've got to be active. We cannot leave our house empty. And yet this man, David, if you go to 1 Samuel 24, there are things said about him which tell us what integrity is all about. 1 Samuel 24, this is a measure of integrity, brothers and sisters. If we've had experiences like this, we then know what it means for a man to be after God's own heart. This was one of two occurrences when God essentially delivered Saul up to David. He could do what he liked. If he wanted to kill him, he could, because he was delivered to him. And David didn't kill him. He realized that he would not lay his hand upon the Lord's anointed, but he did at least cut off part of his skirt. And in verse 5, it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. Now, I think that's a very important feeling to have. I would hope all of us have had it, that we have allowed ourselves to do something and afterwards our heart smote us. We should not have done that. So that it tells us that we're sensitive to right and wrong, that we have a conscience, and the conscience is pricking us. Now, God gave him another chance. If that's really what he felt, then just go over a couple chapters, and David comes down, and there's Saul sleeping, with a sleep so deep that he and Abishai were able to go right up next to him, take his spear at his side. And he had another chance to slay him, but not so. As he says in verse 10 of chapter 26, as Yahweh liveth, Yahweh shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle or perish. Yahweh forbid that I should stretch forth mine hand against Yahweh's anointed. And we know what he did to those who said they had slain the Lord's anointed. Here was a man of integrity. And here's a man that's epitomized by Psalm 15. Have a look at Psalm 15. Psalm 15, apparently, I wouldn't know to prove this or not, apparently was written at the time of the captivity. So it has a context towards people that would be returning from captivity. But it's a very beautiful psalm about who will be in God's kingdom. And there's two things there I'd like to point out. Who shall abide in thy tabernacle, O Yahweh? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? Verse 2, he that walks uprightly, works righteousness, and speaks the truth in his heart. Time doesn't allow us to go on, although we will probably review a little bit of this tomorrow, about other people who spoke the truth in their heart. And I think one of the best examples to go in and look at in detail would be Job. Where if all we see Job as being as self-righteous, then we miss what he says was his normal way of life in Job 33. It's 31, rather. Where it tells us a level of integrity which we wouldn't see today. And yet, God said of him, he was a perfect and an upright man who eschewed evil, who walked before him acceptably. And then again in Psalm 15, down to verse 4, a person that swears to his own hurt and changeth not. Like Joshua, who made this agreement with the Gibeonites, and then he wouldn't change because they had sworn before Yahweh. Or as Jephthah, who had made the oath before Yahweh and would fulfill what he said he would do with the first one that met him coming out of his house. But today people make vows before God that they will keep them for better or worse till death do them part. And then when they get in the slightest little bit of difficulty, they part. Have we lost sight of integrity, brothers and sisters? Because there's no use even contemplating anything else about building a temple, either personally, in the family, or in the ecclesia, if we don't have that integrity, so that we will be personally honest in our heart, and we will follow it through to its logical end. We have about a minute. Let's just look at Acts chapter 24. we don't have necessarily a lot of examples to deal with in the Apostle Paul's life, but this summary verse would illustrate a target for us in this manner of integrity. So the apostle says in verse 16 of Acts 24, "Herein do I exercise myself, to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. So that knowing the body of the truth, brothers and sisters, and knowing the lifestyle that it requires of us, God's provided us a conscience to guide us in what we're doing. So that if that conscience is a good conscience, not seared, not hardened or thickened, but sensitive, we'll be building. Because our conscience won't allow us to sit idly by. Our conscience will provoke us to get out into the action and to continue to build personally and with our families and with our ecclesias. And we certainly would pray to our Heavenly Father that He would give us the courage to stand apart, because there's not many that have that level of integrity today and are manifesting it in those three areas.
This is day two of the 1989 Idlewild Bible School. Our second period teacher is Brother Frank Abel, and his general subject is Haggai. His subtopic for today's class is Consider Thy Ways.
Well, good morning, everyone. I always like Tuesdays at Bible school because